from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, according to findings by a University of California San Francisco researcher, the sugar industry paid scientists to downplay sugar's role as a risk factor for heart disease back in the 1960s and instead blame fat and cholesterol. In a paper published in JAMA Internal Medicine on Monday, the UCSF authors claim the sugar industry paid Harvard researchers $50,000 in today's dollars to refute sugar's possible role in heart disease, which they claim shaped future policy decisions. We'll discuss the findings and the latest research on sugar's health effects. Join us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. An apparent effort decades ago by the sugar industry to shift the blame from sugar causing heart disease onto fat and cholesterol has come to light. In a paper published in JAMA Internal Medicine on Monday, the UCSF authors claim the sugar industry paid two Harvard researchers $50,000 in 2016 dollars, that was about $6,500 back then, to refute sugar's possible role in heart disease and challenge what was then emerging evidence linking sugar consumption to risk factors for cardiovascular disease. In this opening Forum hour, we discuss the findings and look at the most recent research on the role of sugar and your health. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. I want to welcome first here in studio Dr. Kristen Kearns, who is postdoctoral fellow at University of California, San Francisco School of Dentistry, and she's the lead author of the JAMA Internal Medicine article, who discovered the documents linking the sugar industry to the Harvard scientists. And welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Walter Willett with us, who joins us by phone. He chairs the Department of Nutrition at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We welcome you, Walter Willett. Do we have Walter Willett? Well, let me go next to Michael Moss, then, who is also with us this morning. Michael Moss is a journalist and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and his upcoming book is called Hooked, Food and Free Will. Welcome, Michael Moss.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you. Hi, Kristen, and hopefully Walter, too, because I'm a poor substitute for Walter.
Well, Walter is a call-out. We'll bring him in later into the program. I want to also welcome Christopher Gardner. He's a nutrition scientist, professor of medicine at Stanford Prevention Research Center, and joins us by phone as well. And welcome, Christopher Gardner.
Good morning, Michael and gang.
Good morning. Let me go first to Dr. Kearns, Kristen Kearns. Kristen Kearns, as I said, here with us in studio. This is a kind of bombshell in many people's minds because it seems like a scheme. But let's talk about actually what you discovered. You not only went to Las Vegas, not a place you'd normally associate with archives of this sort, but also University of Illinois. What did you discover?
Well, I was actually able to locate documents in public libraries, believe it or not, that are related to internal communication of a trade group called the Sugar Association, which represents the cane and beet sugar industry. And the first source I found was actually in Colorado, not Las Vegas, so in Fort Collins, Colorado. And it was from a sugar company that had gone out of business in the 1970s called the Great Western Sugar Company. And that led me to a couple other finds, one at the University of Illinois, and they were the papers of a chemist who had been a scientific advisor to the Sugar Research Foundation, which was a predecessor to the Sugar Association. And then that also led me to the Harvard archives once I learned that the sugar industry had begun to fund heart disease research in the 1960s. I was able to locate some correspondence between the trade group and the authors of the first heart disease project at Harvard.
What are we to conclude, though, from the sugar industry giving money? I mean, first of all, the shall we say, separation between industry and academic research didn't exist really to the extent it exists now.
Right. The incredible thing about the correspondence between the authors of this review, which ended up in the New England Journal of Medicine, so it really showed the collaboration between the industry and the researchers. So not only did they pay them, as you said, $50,000 in today's dollars, but they actually communicated back and forth about what the review should be about, which studies should be critiqued. It was a review of the evidence at the time linking sugar to heart disease. So the industry had a say in which studies the authors should look at and include. The industry had a chance to review drafts ahead of time before publication. So they were highly involved, and that's really unusual. You know, that's not how science is supposed to work.
And it decreased the notion of, say, polyunsaturated fat or fat for saturated fat, or the idea, in fact, you have to have margarine instead of butter, this sort of thing, or sugar-free, fat-free cookies.
That's right. It was a two-part review, and they did two things. One, they discounted the evidence linking sugar to coronary heart disease, and then they said that the best thing to do to prevent heart disease would be to limit saturated fat and replace it with polyunsaturated fats and reduce your dietary cholesterol.
And we're talking about one researcher who was the head of nutrition at the Department of Agriculture, who was the head of nutrition department at Harvard.
That's right. So the senior author on this
both
paper—
Both deceased now.
Right. They're both have died. The senior author on the paper, Fred Stair, at the time was the chair of the nutrition department at Harvard. Mark Hegstead was the main correspondent with the sugar industry. Both of those scientists went on to be very influential in nutrition science, in counseling various groups such as the American Heart Association, advising the folks who put together our first dietary goals. These guys were very influential in what we know about nutrition.
Sugar Association has essentially said, you know, we invited them on, of course, they declined, but that they just didn't have the information then. This was 60 years ago. In other words, I think implying maybe making a big deal out of something that shouldn't be made into a big deal.
Right. Well, the thing is, we're still debating the science linking added sugars to coronary heart disease. And I think what's important about this analysis that we did is it really shows that the industry has tried to influence the debate for more than 60 years. And we only looked at one snapshot in time. You know, I can tell you that this wasn't the only heart disease research project that they funded. They continued to fund research throughout the 1960s and the 1970s and probably beyond that. So I expect that we'll, when we start looking, find a lot more influence out there.
Well, I found a lot more, actually. In 1964, John Hixon, who was a top sugar executive, actually planned with others to shift public opinion in research through information, through legislative programs, and so forth. So, I mean, this is all a part of the public record. But let me bring Michael Moss into this, who is a journalist and author, wrote the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and his upcoming book is called Hooked, Food and Free Will. Some pushback from you on this, Michael?
Well, I actually loved what sort of the last thing that Kristen said was sort of emphasizing that the industry has been trying to influence public policy. And it is sort of unclear to me sort of how successful they've been in that regard. But first, just kind of looking at the money, I mean, there's no question that sort of industry funding of science is a really problematic thing. It seems to be getting more problematic because researchers are having more trouble finding government money for good nutrition studies. And companies, food companies especially, are all too eager to sort of step in and fund studies that Mary Nessel at NYU has done a terrific job of showing that they, for the large majority, you know, please the funders to no ends by finding what they hope they will find. And that either means that the science is corrupted or they're doing studies, you know, on sure bets that they know the results are going to sort of help them out. I was taken aback by this 67 Harvard review, though, by one thing it did disclose, which was funding for their experiments from the dairy board, where at the same time they skewered saturated fats, the main component of dairy products. So I just thought that was actually rather amusing. The funding that they did disclose was a hand that they very harshly bit with their findings. You know, the second thing on the science, I mean, I think a question here, and again, Kristen's looked at this, and I'm not sure other people have had a chance yet, but my sense from people who are no fans of sugar is that way back then, the science on sugar connecting it to heart disease was, in fact, very weak, and that the question is, would any reasonable person have come to any other conclusion than Hegstead et al. Sort of did in this paper? I mean, even as late as 1980, you know, Michael Jacobson, the very activist scientist at the Consumer for Public Interest, was trying to get the FTC to cut back on advertising junky food to kids. But he went after cavities because he didn't have the scientific ammunition to attack sugar based on connections to heart disease. And as Kristen sort of pointed out, even today, some people are accepting kind of the industry's main defense, which is, look, sugar is just, and I'm exaggerating their defense here, but sugar is just an equal opportunity killer if you get too much of it, along with too much saturated fat or too much salt or too many calories or too much junk food generally. And don't single us out as the evil one. I think that's what we've seen kind of from all of these components of processed foods, trying to point the finger at the other one. It was just trying to be a little unequal footing. And then lastly, and I'll shut up, but Hegseth was really surprising this because he was known as a really straight shooter.
He provided the nutritional guidelines, didn't he?
Well, yeah, and in his testimony to the McGovern Committee, not long after this review and the nutritional guidelines, I mean, he was saying stuff like, you know, eat less food, eat less sugar, eat less saturated fat, get fewer calories, eat less meat. I'm told that he was run out of the FDA for encouraging people to eat less meat. And so the notion that he would be a shill even for the sugar company is actually very astounding to people. So I'm wondering if there might just be more to this correspondence than meets the eye.
Well, we should mention again that Hegseth was the head nutrition for the Department of Agriculture. But the science of sugar, some would argue, is still weak. And yet you have people here, for example, our own San Francisco, University of California, San Francisco's Bob Lustig, who has made sugar into a really serious toxic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a scientist. I mean, I write more about the food industry's use of salt, sugar, fat as weapons, if you will, in their hands to get us to eat more of their stuff, as opposed to sort of the individual danger of any one of those components. But people I trust, you know, in that field are still of the mind that, and to repeat myself, equal opportunity killers if we get too much of those components and that. And it's probably not too smart to focus on any one individual of them, at least given the science today. We may be proven wrong, and the people who see sugar as the evil poison may be proven right one of these days, but I don't think we're there yet.
Well, we have had some other research in terms of trying to turn the tide with research. Coca-Cola, for example, spent an extraordinary amount of money to do research to downplay the link of sugar and obesity, and candy manufacturers funded research that says essentially that kids who use a lot of candy or eat a lot of candy tend to weigh less than kids who don't. So we have these things again on the public record. But I'd mentioned Walter Willett before, and I want to bring him into this before we go to Christopher Gardner, who is the nutritionist we have with us from the School of Medicine, professor of medicine at Stanford. But Walter Willett, again, chairs the Department of Nutrition with the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Walter Willett, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I'm very eager to hear what you have to say about this with respect to Harvard and what their response is to this article that appeared in JAMA.
Well, I don't think I'm speaking for the institution, but I am chair of the department in which Dr. Hegseth worked 55 years ago. And in fact, I sat in on his classes. And as Mr. Moss said, he was a real intellectual, data-driven person. I doubt that he changed what he would say on the basis of getting money for this review. And as was pointed out, he, in fact, stood up to industry in a very big way, lost his job at USDA because of his recommendations to reduce consumption of red meat in particular.
But I'm sure you understand what this looks like when researchers are paid by today's standards, yeah?
Absolutely. And having said that, clearly, even by yesterday's standards, it was not a good thing to be taking money for writing a review. And today, we go to great lengths to keep at arm's length from the industry in our research and in writing reviews. And, of course, there's since 1980s, quite strict standards by medical journals on disclosure. So there were two issues, three issues here at least. One was failure to disclose. It wasn't a rule. That was customary practice at that time. It's really good that we do have disclosure now. But then influence even above and beyond disclosure. And I completely agree with what Mr. Moss said, that there is a serious problem of industry attempts and sometimes successful attempts to distort research and distort scientific messages. And in most recent years, the beverage industry has been particularly egregious in this way. But it really, I think, a very important conclusion here is that public funding for research is critically important. But that's a little bit, that's a bigger picture issue. It's not really related to this review because that wasn't really primary research. It was a review. And for reviews, it's actually particularly important to be unbiased because in some ways studies, the data are the data and you can critique them, but reviews do rely somewhat on judgment for emphasis and critique. And it really is important to be as biased as one possibly can.
Well, what do you think the result of this research was retrospectively in terms of how it affected attitudes toward other causes of cardiovascular disease and the like? I mean, the implication is, to some extent, as we heard from Dr. Kearns, that it had a great deal of effect.
It's really hard to determine cause and effect. I think it's one paper. Clearly, there were other activities of the sugar industry, the beverage industry, to manage public opinion. But I think, as Mr. Moss said, that the scientific evidence was really at that time much stronger for not total fat, but for replacing saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat. And if you read the article, that's what really Hegstead talked about. And it wasn't, the article is really not correct, the JAMA Internal Medicine article. There were many, many studies that had shown that replacing saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat had reduced total serum cholesterol. And at that time, it was well established that total serum cholesterol was a strong predictor for heart disease. So there was limited evidence compared to what we have today, but that was the best available evidence. And you didn't have that for sugar. Sugar compared to average fat or monounsaturated fat has a pretty neutral effect on blood total cholesterol. It wasn't until later that we recognized that you needed to break total cholesterol down into HDL cholesterol and LDL, and that triglycerides were important. The picture became much more complex, and today we have a much better understanding, perhaps not perfect understanding, but how different types of fat affect risk of heart disease. So the evidence was not similar. We didn't have that kind of evidence for sugar. There was not agreement, and even today still debate about the independent effect of triglycerides.
If I could jump in on the perception,
heart disease.
Michael.
Yeah.
So one of the things I've sort of tracked for the writing I've done on the food industry is sort of their own perception of where their problems lie. And I never see the food giants, you know, suddenly saying, hey, wow, nobody cares about sugar anymore. Sugar, you know, remained a problematic ingredient to them through the 70s, through the 80s. The cereal companies were all trying to take the word sugar out of their cereals in the 80s. And maybe some of that was because of concern about cavities or just plain calories or what have you. But sugar kind of remained, to the industry anyway, this very problematic thing.
Well, let me jump in because they were scaling back, and I know that's been a lot of your work, Michael Moss, talking about how a lot of it was scaling back in ways that didn't necessarily benefit consumers, and there were these ongoing studies with sugary drinks and so forth, and trying to, the Blue Point test, for example,
absolutely, and they were engineering that, and the problem wasn't that they engineered sort of the perfect amount of sugar in things like soda and cookies and candy, things we know should be sweet and expect to be sweet. You know, the problem is they've marched around the grocery store adding sugar to things that never became sweet before, so now. Now, by some estimates, 75% of the groceries that we're exposed to have added sugar in them and Bliss points for sweetness, and that that's created this expectancy on us that everything should taste sweet, which is a real problem, especially for kids when you drag them over to the produce aisle and try to get them to eat broccoli sprouts or something with some of those other basic tastes that Aristotle wrote about. You know, you have a rebellion on your hands. I mean, that. So
forgive me, Michael. I want to actually bring. We were coming up on a break here, and I want to get Christopher Gardner into this discussion to weigh in here because Christopher Gardner can tell us about how things have changed. I mean, isn't it true the World Health Organization used to say you shouldn't have no more than 10% sugar, and now it was 20% in America. Now it is down to 10, right?
Right. No, it was 25% in the U.S.
25%. Yeah.
And the Nutrition Facts panel itself has a column suggesting, you know, what percent of your daily value have you hit and warning you not to go over. And that percent was missing for sugar. It was there for saturated fat, and it was there for other things. So clearly, there's some really strong industry influence on the politics of guidelines for things like that. If you look at the wording of the dietary guidelines, which get updated every 5 years, it's fascinating to see how the wording changed. I wrote it down just for fun in 1980. Avoid too much sugar. In 1985, use sugars only in moderation. Then choose a diet moderate in sugars. Choose beverages and foods to moderate your intake of sugars. And 2005, choose carbohydrates wisely. So they continued to have information on sugar and avoiding sugar. But the language that the USDA used to translate the advice of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which gets assembled a couple years before they renew the guidelines every 5 years, is usually watered down by the media savvy folks, which has got to be influenced by the industry.
Well, we're going to have to say goodbye, unfortunately, to Walter Willett. Walter Willett, thank you so much for joining us. Walter Willett, again, is chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. But we are going to continue with Christopher Gardner from Stanford and Michael Moss, journalist and author, and Dr. Kristen Kearns, who's here with us in studio, postdoctoral fellow at the UCSF School of Dentistry, who actually was the lead author of this JAMA Internal Medicine article. And we want to hear from you. In fact, let me invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. I know many of you have questions or comments and want to weigh in where sugar is concerned with your thoughts. So feel free to join us now. Let me give you the toll-free number, which you can use to call us, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. That number to call, 866-733-6786. And you can call us now. We'll go to your calls forthwith. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. There are, of course, other ways to communicate your thoughts or bring your questions to the fore here. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Just a quick comment from Mikkel, who says, please be sure you clarify that contrary to some of the press reporting, the underlying data that the scientists were looking at did not exonerate saturated fat as a cause of heart disease, but rather implicated both sugar and saturated fat. That's a fact, Kristen Kearns?
Let's talk about that when you come back.
All right, and we'll also hear from listeners when we come back. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. According to findings by University of California, San Francisco researcher Dr. Kristen Kearns, who is here with us this morning, the sugar industry paid scientists to downplay sugar's role as a risk factor for heart disease back in the 1960s and blame fat and cholesterol instead. And we're talking about that, also talking about sugar and your health and what science there is in terms of sugar's, shall we say, deleterious effects or negative effects. As I said, Dr. Kearns is with us. We also spoke with Walter Willett from Harvard, chair of the Department of Nutrition there, and Michael Moss with us, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, has a book coming up called Hooked, Food and Free Will, and Christopher Gardner is nutrition scientist and professor of medicine at Stanford's Prevention Research Center. We're going to go to your calls and emails here as soon as we can, but Dr. Kearns wanted to respond to a comment from a listener who wanted to clarify that saturated fat as a cause of heart disease was not exonerated, but rather implicated along with sugar and saturated fat.
Well, I also want to speak to the strength of evidence at the time that both Walter and Michael questioned back in the 60s. Looking at the industry-funded review, there was actually an amazing amount of evidence just as a reader linking sugar to heart disease back then. They quoted studies, epidemiological studies. They quoted experimental studies in humans and animals. They actually had plausible biological mechanisms to explain how sugar was exactly linked to heart disease. And it was not only a link to cholesterol, but it was a link to triglycerides in the blood. So this review found that sugar raised cholesterol levels, that sugar raised triglyceride levels, as did saturated fat. So yes, all of those things were implicated. But what the review did is really criticize the studies linking sugar to cholesterol and sugar to triglycerides, and really didn't criticize those studies linking saturated fat, nor did they really criticize the studies saying that polyunsaturated fats were a good thing to improve heart disease. But they really criticized replacing sugar with vegetables or replacing sugar with complex carbohydrates as interventions that weren't feasible. So they applied this real double standard to the evidence back then.
All right, I want to go to your calls. Let me go to a couple of questions first, though. And Michael Moss, for you, Ben writes, corporations have spent billions crafting their own reality, and we, the consumers, are not only getting false information, but also being injured by these lies. My question is, how can we put people in jail?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, probably in the vast majority of circumstances, there aren't laws in place to actually make something like this criminal. One of the most basic, hardest things for a journalist is just sort of to look at a scientific study and tell whether it's any good, regardless of kind of the source of funding. There are researchers out there, like there are journalists, who are just lousy and don't know how to do a good study. There are researchers who have a bias going into a study, and it's really, really difficult. And we're kind of in this era now of publish or perish, and things are moving so fast that it's really difficult as a consumer to sort of trust any of the reporting, and to some extent even some of the science, especially in nutrition sciences, which is so difficult to do and kind of so ever changing in its view of kind of what the most important things are. I kind of dodged his question. I'm sorry.
But I think you actually answered it in terms of our present criminal justice system and maybe need for new criminal laws on the books. Let me go to Christopher Gardner, who again is a nutrition scientist and professor of medicine at Stanford's Prevention Research Center. And before I go to our calls, I want to get a question out here to you, Christopher Gardner, from a listener who says, sad fact is that when I read the labels in the supermarket, I find sugars in one form or another, especially high fructose syrup, existing in extremely high levels in nearly all the food products. That happens to be probably the case, is it not, Christopher Gardner?
Oh, sure. There's 30, 40, 50 different names for sugars, and the way the law is written, you have to list the ingredient in the highest amount first. But if you have 20 different kinds of sugar, you can scatter them throughout the ingredient list, so it looks like several other ingredients are at the highest level, when in fact, if you total them, it would be added sugar, which is actually the good news is the FDA has just approved redesigning the nutrition facts panel. It will now list added sugar separate from others. All of those added sugars will be put together. So instead of reading the ingredient list, you could go right to that numerical nutrition facts panel and see what that added sugar amount is in total.
Could I ask you quickly, though, because I know you did a lot of study on this, about artificial sweeteners? You did some research and others have done research. We don't really have anything very conclusive, do we?
So the fascinating thing, and this is in response to a lot of things that got said today, wouldn't it be great if a scientist could help the public and come up with some really clear answers? But unfortunately, these studies are really hard to run with foods. Food behaviors, food preferences are so complex. So I find that when I write a grant and publish a paper, to have an answerable question, test a hypothesis, and get an answer and report it, it's a very narrow question. So instead of, you know, is sugar bad for you or is sugar okay, it's this dose of sugar delivered in that form to that many people for that many days for this one thing. And if that one thing happens to be LDL cholesterol and it doesn't go up but everything else goes to hell, then I'm not really allowed to talk about the other stuff because my hypothesis was the one risk factor. And what we really need to look at is the totality of food behaviors and the totality of health effects. And our scientific system isn't really set up to look generally and communicated that effectively to the public.
There's a lot of need for research. In fact, I'm looking at another comment here from a listener who wants to know where we can find resources to fight sugar addiction cravings. And then there are those who say you shouldn't use the word addiction when you're talking about but she goes on to say, when you're talking about sugar, she says, like so many baby boomer women, I was brought up eating sugar at every meal. Just saying no doesn't work. Is there a transitional food? Are there programs out there? Do anti-anxiety medicines help? I mean, weaning people off sugar is a big question in terms of where research ought to go. But let me go to your calls, because I know many of you want to speak with our experts and get on the air here. And let me go first to Banchu. First caller up. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Michael. I'm a big fan. So I have a comment. I think it's not the sugars to be blamed. I think we should be blaming the whole processed food industry. I think till the time processed food is cheaper than natural food, a big bunch of people are not going to make the right choice at every single step and for every single meal of the day.
Blame the processed food industry, Michael Moss?
Well, you know, I was really struck in my reporting about how many people there are inside the processed food industry who are blaming themselves and urging their companies to start doing the right thing by consumers to sort of truly invent some truly better for you products. So they were totally concurring with your caller, and this is years and years ago. One of the fascinating things we see now is that because more and more people are caring about what they put in their bodies and they're acting on those cares in making their purchase decisions, all of the largest food companies were reporting dismal profits last year, and they're all now scrambling to present a better picture of themselves, in part by cutting back on salt, sugar, fat, you know, calories even. And this is a bit of confession on my part, but as much as I've sort of harped on salt, sugar, fat as being the sort of unholy trinity in the hands of the food industry, when you talk to nutritionists, cutting back on salt, sugar, fat isn't kind of the first thing that they mention. The first thing they mention is, you know, double down on vegetables and whole fruits and start changing your diet that way. And then some of the other things will start anyway.
Sort of. Michael, forgive me though. If I'm not mistaken, and perhaps you can rectify if I am. I seem to remember that Campbell's Soups cut down their sodium, and they made a big deal out of the fact that they were cutting down their sodium, and their sales went way down, and so they decided, you know, this isn't working.
Yeah, the industry has always argued that, look, we're companies, we're not philanthropies. There's no way we're going to change our formulas if people don't go along with them. And it's a bit of a catch-22 because having sort of hooked us on high levels of salt, if you will, it takes some time to get off of that. But you can do it. I mean, anybody who's been on a low-salt diet from under doctor's orders knows that in 5 or 6 weeks, you can hardly touch much of the stuff in the grocery store because it seems so salty. You've reduced your threshold of sort of salt liking. And you know, one of the surprising things is that the industry itself is much more hooked on these ingredients than we are. So I'm actually more hopeful about our ability to sort of unhook ourselves. But it takes time.
Yeah, it does indeed, and we want to get more of your calls on here. Let me go next to Bryce. Bryce, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me. I was just going to say, I think because of all the incentives, the addictiveness of the product, the money that these companies put into politics, the only way this is really going to change is if the science can get us to a point where we can link specific diseases and damages the way we did with tobacco and cost money to this industry. It's the only thing that's really going to change it.
All right. I thank you for that. We'll let it stand as an editorial comment. We'll get another caller on here, and that's Mary. Mary, you're on. Morning.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
As somebody who grew up in Crockett, I actually have an affinity for sugar, C&H Sugar Home. but the reason I'm calling is to ask the speakers to talk about the natural alternatives and compare and contrast their interaction with the body and heart disease. Like, I use stevia. I sometimes use agave and honey. How do those compare to sugar?
That's a good question, and we'll go to you, Christopher Gardner, if we may.
Yeah, so it is a great question, and for the diabetes educator who got somebody off of regular soda onto diet soda, that's clearly a good thing, less calories, less sugar. When it comes to a lot of products with these added sugars, we find it really hard to do a compelling study. As soon as you've taken the sugar out, it's not just that you've taken it out and added the artificial sweetener. There's food chemistry issues going on where you change the food in other ways quite hard to conduct a really simple study to see what's going on. I have to say my knee-jerk reaction is the only place you find artificial sweeteners is in packaged processed, usually junk food. So the switch from packaged processed junk food with sugar to packaged processed junk food with artificial sweetener is not a big leap, unfortunately.
Let me read a comment here and go to you, if I could, Kristen Kearns. This is AJ who says, this is exactly talking again about your work and what you published in JAMA, why believing any scientific study is difficult these days. Funding disclosures behind all scientific reports need to be mandated, but I guess lobbyists won't be doing that. Now, would you want someone to conclude from the work you've done that they shouldn't trust the kind of research that's going on now as opposed to then when, as I said, people turned a blind eye to the links between industry and research?
Well, I think it's important to be skeptical and to be critical of research, particularly if the food industry has funded the work. I mean, we've seen that beverage industries funding studies of the relationship between their product and weight outcomes is much more likely to show that there's not an effect between drinking soda and weight than if the industry has not funded it. And this work continues to go on today. So having a critical eye is really important, even for consumers.
And we'll go to more of your calls. And let me bring in Larry. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, I have a friend who's Chinese, and she thinks that letting her children eat lots of grapes, lots of mango, lots of natural sugar fruit is no different from is better than eating processed sugar. Could your guest please clarify the difference between processed sugar, corn syrup, that type of sugar, and the natural sugars that come in fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, can we go again to you, Christopher Gardner?
Yeah, sure. Metabolically, there's no difference. It won't recognize the difference, but it's what it comes with. So when you eat it with natural foods, it comes with all kinds of nutrients that came along with that food. And when you add added sugar to something, it doesn't come with anything else. And so the huge benefit is what else it comes with.
And maybe we can go to you, Christopher Gardner, for a question that's hovering over this whole conversation. Michael Moss said, you know, the best thing to do is to stuff yourself with fruits and vegetables. Can you perhaps give us some more light and wisdom on what people should be eating for good nutrition just for the moment here?
Sure, absolutely. And one of the things we do have to bring back to this whole conversation is the pleasure of food and enjoying food. So this idea of depriving yourself of things that you enjoy for the sake of health has really not worked as a public health message for the last 20 or 30 years. I've been having a lot of fun collaborating with our Stanford Dining Group and with the Culinary Institute of America around delicious food. You can make vegetables delicious and tantalizing, and there's herbs and spices, and they haven't really done a very good job of that. People, I've been a vegetarian for a long time, and I roll into a party, and they've got one of those plates with raw broccoli florets and ranch dressing and said, we're so happy we'd be here to accommodate you. And I gag on raw broccoli florets. But to make a move in that direction of more whole grains, more vegetables, more fruits, more beans, more legumes, we've got to take advantage of the cultures of the world that always made those in more delicious ways than we do now, trying to Americanize them and make them convenient and fast. So, yes, eat more of the good foods as opposed to penalizing people for the bad foods that they eat. That message doesn't work.
And I'm bringing another caller. Josh, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Long-time listener, commuting from Auburn to San Francisco. Just want to say, Forks Over Knives is a great documentary with two doctors who grew up in the dairy and the meat industry and found out that dairy and meat, not good for our bodies because it was not originally meant for us. But they take type 2 diabetes patients and high cholesterol people, and they bring down their weight and, just going with basic vegetables, subsidizing protein through vegetables. But also, you guys are talking about sugar, but sugar is so loosely played right now. I mean, when was corn subsidized and high fructose corn syrup? You're looking at, 50s, 60s?
Yeah, we've certainly talked about this, and thank you, Josh, with people like Michael Pollan and again, Bob Lustig. It gets into a whole other question, maybe, Michael Moss, for you, and that is, and a lot of listeners are asking, where are the regulations, or do we have enough science that we can actually move in that direction?
Boy, I mean, is there enough science to actually, it is. I mean, the record. Well,
Michael Bloomberg would have said yes. I mean, soda taxes and things of that sort, right?
All right, to sort of discourage. Yeah, I mean, I really love sort of the concept of nudge marketing, sort of, not preaching to people about the value of vegetables, but maybe getting them excited about vegetables through great culinary skills and even some clever marketing. I wrote about a campaign for broccoli, for example, sort of designed along the lines of, or by companies that work for, a company that works for Coca-Cola and sort of know how to hit those emotional buttons that we tend to sort of eat junk food with, as just an example of what can be done. But I don't know if we need, the sugar tax is a whole other thing. I've actually come around on that. I used to think that was probably not a great thing, but if that money can be spent on things that help people, especially, I mean, if you could, like, for instance, use money from that tax, to put a garden in every school in the country, I think that would just be fantastic.
Well, I'm looking at a comment from a listener who writes, and this is important for our local listeners here. Diane says, we have three cities here in the Bay Area trying to pass policies to reduce sugar consumption, Prop V in San Francisco, Measure HH in Oakland, and O1 in Albany, all taxed. The distributors of sugary drinks, in light of this new revelation about the industry influencing policy and guidelines, these policies are even more important. Kristen Kearns.
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence that added sugars are linked to chronic disease. Just look at tooth decay, which is the number one chronic disease in children. And we've known that for decades. And the reason why we focused on tooth decay more than anything else, as Michael Moss had mentioned, related to Hegseth or CSPI back in the 70s, is because the sugar industry actually also influenced our first safety review of sugar that the FDA did in 1976. And Gary Taubes and I wrote about that in Mother Jones back in 2012. And so they used some of these same techniques to shift the focus off of the link between heart disease, diabetes, and obesity. And really, the only link that was made to a disease back then was tooth decay. And so that's why CSPI was really only able to talk about that as an effect of sugar consumption. I think the evidence today is really bearing out what was being looked at back in the 1960s. And I think that any efforts to help limit consumption will make significant improvements in chronic disease.
And once again, Dr. Kristen Kearns is postdoctoral fellow at UCSF School of Dentistry and was the lead author of the JAMA Internal Medicine article. And she discovered the documents linking the sugar industry to the Harvard scientists back in the mid-60s. Here's a comment from Mark who says, this is why we should rigorously be supporting scientific study, especially basic research, through an independent university system. We've allowed the corporatization of academic research, which has resulted in the release of grossly biased studies. It's our fault, folks, when taxpayers prefer to pay for useless sports arenas instead of independent scientific research. We all suffer in the long run. Let me get some more of your calls on here, and let's go next to Aaron. Aaron, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hi there. Actually, this is related to the comment you just read, but as a future researcher, one of the things I've observed and one of the things I'm concerned about is this kind of getting the results we want to get whenever we research things. And when we have studies funded by these, sugary drink manufacturers, the food industry, et cetera. And this goes for other industries as well. You can go back to, I guess, the 70s with, oil companies knowing about climate change and whatever. What infrastructure can we set up that will prevent this kind of getting the results we want to get, this kind of we have to publish or die, and the people who are going to fund our research are these giant corporations who want to fund their own efforts?
Well, thank you for that question. And Aaron, let me go again to Michael Moss. Michael Moss, you heard Walter Willett, whom I assume you have a good deal of respect for, say there's a very clear line now between research institutions and corporatization.
Well, yes. It's a clear line in terms of disclosure, but the sort of food industry is still funding a large sum of research out there that, yes, when the studies are published, there is disclosure of that funding. But that disclosure often gets lost even in sort of mainstream media reporting on the study findings as an asterisk sort of footnote. And so your average consumer sort of has less chance of sort of weighing that likely bias in that kind of research. And the problem I keep hearing from researchers is that government funding is drying up, and they're having to turn to industry for funding in a way that they're not comfortable with.
Yeah, we've been hearing that a good deal here on this program, too. And by the way, you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Michael Moss and also Kristen Kearns and Christopher Gardner. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we will go to more of your calls. We'll go to Stephanie next. Stephanie, you're on. Morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I was doing some research on this topic last spring, and I ran into some interesting articles. But I do have one question first, which is I had read that California legislature was considering a warning label on sugary beverages, but I'm not really sure what happened with that. Does anyone know where that is at right now?
Anybody?
No.
I think it passed one of the houses in California and then stalled. That's my best guess on that.
We'll see if we can dig up an answer to that question. Stephanie, thank you for it, or if one of our listeners knows offhand. I'm sorry, I don't. But I do have a request from a number of listeners, and let me go to you again, Christopher Gardner, who want clarification on sugar and carbs and sugars in fruits and vegetables. Is the sugar from carbohydrate assimilation not also harmful?
This is all in the context of food. This is what. So let's not single out carbs. Let's not single out sugar. Let's think Mediterranean diet, Asian diet, Latin American diet. We really get in trouble when we pick on carbs or sugars. That's where a lot of the controversy arises. And in fact, that's a tool that the industry uses. So if you have a wonderful wheat berry salad or some fantastic Asian stir fry over brown rice, and it incorporates fabulous taste and mixes of carbs, fats, proteins, vitamins, minerals, et cetera. And then you get somebody who does a very isolated study with one sugar, and it does something deleterious or it doesn't. That gets tossed out as disinformation to confuse the public. So I wish we would focus less on carbs and sugar and more on this influence that the industry does have. So hats off to Kristen for bringing this to the fore, because it is problematic. It would take an entire show to go over carbs versus fats and single sugars. I wish we'd get away from it and just talk about food.
Well, let's just ask you another question here that's related. It comes from Michael, one of our listeners, who wants to know, we'll get back to sugar for a moment, are there good genomic studies regarding the effects of sugar?
Good genomic studies? Like, are people predisposed? One of the research areas that I'm involved in right now is two people being overweight who look the same on the outside and they're metabolically quite different on the inside. One person is very pre-diabetic and the other actually very metabolically healthy. And so if that's what the question is getting at in terms of genomics, I think there is some level of predisposition to handling certain nutrients in our foods like carbs.
Going back,
that's funny, but I thought when I read that question, again, maybe talking about addiction. You know, there's some genomic idea about alcoholism and so forth. I think maybe it was leaning toward that in the question. I don't know. Do you want to weigh in here, Kirsten Coons?
I wanted to go back again to our study, looking back at the evidence in the 1960s. And what researchers were discussing back then was that a subgroup of the population might actually be sensitive to sucrose. So a certain segment had this response, this triglyceride response, when they ate fairly normal levels of sugar. So they were looking at maybe targeting different segments of the population with different types of nutrition advice. Those who had high cholesterol levels needed to limit fat. Those with high triglyceride levels needed to limit sugar. So there was some segmentation back then. And I think the industry had a role in shifting the focus off of triglycerides as a risk factor for heart disease.
Just want to read a comment from Jen who says, I'd love to see someone add Starbucks into the conversation. People shouldn't be starting the day with a mocha frappuccino, sugar, caffeine, and no nutritional value at all. A lot of opinions along those lines. But let me get another call on here. Anchi Balta, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner in Oakland, but I'm a huge fan of Weston Price, who was a dentist in the 1920s who found a correlation between the elimination of healthy fats and enormous problems in development and tooth decay. And he found that tooth decay was actually not just a problem, not like a base problem, but actually an indicator of a general debilitation of the body. So I think it's going to be tough with the industry because that information is not 40 years old. That information is 80 years old, and it was largely ignored, even though he was a big, prominent dentist in the industry and like wrote articles for the dental.
Do you know anything about him, Dr. Kearns?
Sure. Yes, he was a big figure in the American Dental Association, and his work was very important at the time. And I think that very similarly, I believe industry probably questioned his research and really minimized it. And lots of people are coming back to realize that maybe he had it right to begin with.
Well, we have run out of time here. This is a subject that we could keep going with, and I'm sorry for those callers, emailers, and those who posted on our web that we didn't get to you. But it's a subject, obviously, that hits a pretty strong nerve. Let me thank Dr. Kearns, Kristen Kearns, postdoctoral fellow at UCSF School of Dentistry, who is with us. Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and his upcoming book is called Hooked, Food and Free Will. And Christopher Gardner, nutrition scientist and professor of medicine with Stanford's Prevention Research Center. We also talk with Walter Willett, chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.